You're going to be making lots of noise out there. Well, welcome to the talk tonight by Frank Chadwick. This is part of the War College. My name is Dana Lombardi, and this is the War College that we have again each year at Celesticon. Frank, again, is one of our guests of honor at the convention. And although Frank does a lot of historical stuff, he's known for that, including historical fantasy, like Space 1889. He also does now, as a published science fiction author, your hard science fiction material, which you have a whole series that started. And you also have steampunk as well. Mm-hmm. And you're going to talk to us tonight about writing science fiction and also maybe how to get published.
I can share a little bit on that. I mean, my road to being published is probably a little unusual. I'm not sure how much benefit people get from, but I will share
it all. Share it all with us.
Yes, I'll share what I have.
Please, Frank, go ahead.
Thanks, Dana. My name is Frank Chadwick. Some of you probably know me. Mostly for gaming. For the last couple of years, actually for about the last 15 years, I've been seriously writing fiction. I've been actually finally getting published in the last few years. It takes a while, partially because you've got to write a lot. In my opinion, you've got to write quite a bit before you get any good. You've got to write poorly before you can write well. You've got to write badly and keep writing and then see what's wrong with it and fix it. And, you know, you can't sit down at the piano and start playing the first time you do it. You've got to practice. And I think writing's the same way. Sometimes we don't have that notion in this country. We have this idea that somehow your innate talent will enable you to just sit down and begin turning out your deathless prose, your first shot, you know, your first time out of the gate. I don't believe that. I read about a young woman who is about 16, I think, and her first novel was a critically acclaimed New York Times number one bestseller. And my reaction, as I told somebody, was, burn the witch. You know, I mean, this is not the way, in my experience, people learn how to write. It doesn't just come to them. You really have to work at it. I don't think talent shows in what you write the first time. I think there is such a thing as talent. I think talent's probably an upper limit on how good you can get, but it's not. But getting to that requires hard work, a lot of work, just writing, and really working at your craft. In my opinion, that's the road to good writing is working really hard at getting working hard at your craft. I have two books in print. In addition to a number of ebooks from Untreed Reads, which are in the Space 1889 universe, in February of 2013, Bain Books came out with my debut print novel, which is How Dark the World Becomes. It's now in mass market paperback. It was originally in trade paperback, but it's now come out in mass market paperback as well. And they have purchased the sequel to this from me, although there'll be rewrites, and it's going to be a while before that'll be out, probably about a year. But the sequel to this, tentatively titled Come the Revolution, they don't always like the titles I come up with, so we may have to negotiate what the title is. But right now the working title is Come the Revolution, which is the sequel to How Dark the World Becomes. Hard science fiction. In January of this year, came out with The Forever Engine, which is a steampunk adventure, also from Bain Books. It's a little different sort of steampunk adventure since it starts in our time, or actually a couple of years in the future. And the main character is someone who is transported to this world, but he's a person from our reality. And so the protagonist kind of has our sensibilities, and it has to encounter and deal with this steampunk world. So that gives you a lot. I wanted to do something different than just a traditional steampunk story, and I wanted to be able to look at it from our point of view, and so that's why I picked a protagonist like that. And I had a lot of fun with it. I think I had a lot of fun doing the Forever Engine.
Frank, did you do me a favor?
Yes.
Explain what hard science fiction is and what unhard science fiction is.
Yeah, hard science fiction assumes one change from our current understanding of physics. And so, for example, the traditional one is faster than light travel. Some mechanism is discovered for faster than light travel. But other than that, everything's the same. You know, it's speculative fiction. It's fiction that for the most part is grounded in our current understanding of scientific reality. More towards fantasy science is, of course, the change in there is some sort of supernatural element or magical element, which is the fantasy end of things. And steampunk assumes that. It's usually set in more of a Victorian or Edwardian world. It harkens back to kind of the roots of science fiction, which are H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, and then tries to kind of recreate that somehow. And everybody has kind of a different way of doing it. Sometimes people it's just flat out fantasy. You know, it's Victorian science fiction with vampires and werewolves and stuff like that, and you know. That's fun, but it's pretty far away from hard science fiction. The Forever Engine is actually closer to hard science fiction, even though it ends up being a steampunk world. It comes really close to kind of meshing those together and kind of explaining how they're possible, how they're compatible. So does that answer the question, do you think?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what I want to talk about, what I'm supposed to talk about, is writing science fiction. And in thinking about that, I decided that the place I want to start is what the principal elements of a story are, and what makes science fiction different from some other genres in terms of how it approaches those. And to me, to everybody, the three principal elements of a story are plot, character, and setting. Okay, you know, fundamental building blocks of a story: plot, character, and setting. The emphasis or the importance of the relative importance of those differs from genre to genre and kind of explains how those genres are different, it seems to me. In literary fiction, the most important of those is character. Okay, that is the looming important thing in literary fiction is character, followed by setting, followed by plot. And you know, some literary critics don't like plot at all. Ooh, plot, icky. You know, but character is really important. Setting, rich, detailed setting, very important. And plot, well, you kind of need it, but it's not an afterthought, but it's the least important in terms of the way that genre is defined. In mystery stories, what's the most important thing in a mystery story? The plot, right? The plot is the most important thing. Characters are probably second, you know, interesting. And the how characters give us an insight into who did it and how we discover that, and then kind of the third, the least important of those three is setting. In science fiction and fantasy, the most important element is setting. The setting is in some ways the star of science fiction and fantasy. It's the unique, different world in which the story is set, and the story is a gateway to that world. But the world itself, what makes it different from our world, is really what sets the genre apart and what is the unique appeal of that genre of fiction. The second most important thing is the plot. You know, cranking through this world and you know, flying from planet to planet and fighting the monsters or whatever, putting the ring in the volcano, and the third part is character. Okay, so that the relative hierarchy of importance of those three building blocks kind of sets apart the different genres. And you can find some other genres and make it fit with that too. But I mean, those are three big ones that I think kind of illustrate that point. Okay, so let me talk about those three things in order. The first thing, setting. Setting in science fiction. Setting is world building, and world building is at the core of science fiction and fantasy. The different world that you find yourself in, that the characters find themselves in, is much of the appeal of science fiction, right? I mean, that's kind of what's always drawn people to that, and to fantasy, you know, this different alternate world that people can adventure in, and the story is kind of your gateway to it. Three things I want to say about setting. The first thing has to do with believability. All readers come to a story with a willing suspension of disbelief. They know that this book is a lie. You know, they know that there isn't a person that did this. In fact, they know there's no person by this name. That, you know, the characters in this book, they're all made up. Everything in this book is a lie. But they're willing to suspend that disbelief for the purposes of experiencing the story. And the reason they're willing to do so is that they believe that it's based on some sort of universal experience of life. That the people in it could have been real in a different setting, that they're based upon real people. That the way they interact and the way things happen is a possible way things could happen. So the first thing that you have to do is not kill their willing suspension of disbelief. And when they pick the book up, they're ready to believe. Don't kill it. You've got to nurture it. You can't take it for granted. You've got to do everything you can to make your world believable so that the people can go on with that necessary willing suspension of disbelief. I think you've got to sell your world. So world building is front and center in science fiction and fantasy. You've got to think through your world, and then you've got to sell it to the reader. The reader's got to never stop believing that the world makes internal sense. It may be different than ours. It may be based upon a significant change in science or even the addition of magic if you're talking about fantasy. But it's got to still make sense internally. And as soon as it stops, people are going to say, well, that's bullshit. You know, elves would never act like that, you know, or whatever, you know. So that the first thing is believability. You've really got to work at believability, in my opinion. The second thing is you've got to identify what's uniquely interesting about the world you've built, because just making it different isn't enough. You know, this is a world just like ours, but everybody eats their corn this way instead of this way. No, that's not enough. You know, everybody's left-handed. You know, and they eat with different silverware. Not enough. You know, who cares? There has to be something really unique and compelling about the world that makes people want to explore that world as opposed to ours. There's got to be something about it that makes it unique, not only different from ours, but also unique from any other fictional world. Because if it's, you know, this is a world just like Tolkien's world, except, you know, orcs have four ears instead of two. Not different enough. You know, it's got to be unique from other fictional worlds as well. It's really got to be a place that your reader can't experience any place else, and really, but also wants to experience. And how do you make it interesting? How do you make it uniquely interesting? And to me, the key to it being unique and interesting is that it surprises you. That when the reader is reading it, they'll go, wow, I never thought of that. You know, you've got to be a step ahead of your reader, and you've got to be able to surprise your reader with the stuff you come up with. What surprises us interests us, and I think that's an important key in understanding how we experience almost everything. But what surprises us interests us. And then the third thing I would say is, having said all this stuff about selling your world, the importance of understanding your world and getting and selling it to your readers, you can't do it by just explaining it to them. You can't just have a bunch of dead exposition. You can't have pages of, and then the emperor, you know, got on his horse and rode out 30 years ago. I mean, you can't make it a history book. You can't make it a science textbook. You can't tell them anything about the world until they need to know it to follow the story. In other words, the stuff that you tell them about the world has to be forced. They have to wonder about it first. The plot has to draw the world out of you. You have to tell them it, like feed it to them as they need it to understand the plot, instead of having big, long sections of exposition. So that leads me to our second major area, which is plot. And I would say that in the simplest terms, in science fiction, plot is the excuse you have for revealing your world. Okay, you kind of got that from the last part, right? The plot is what makes you tell people about this world. It's how they find out about the world. They're following an adventure, or a hero, a heroine, a group of people. They encounter stuff. Stuff happens to them, and in order to understand it and in order to cope with it, the reader's got to find out about the world. So it's their curiosity about the world that that makes them compel you to tell them. But the plot has to be your mechanism for getting people to understand the world. So that's the first thing I would say, is that it is the excuse, or it should be the compelling reason, that you reveal the world to readers. The second thing I would say is that the unfolding events of the plot are essential to keeping the readers interested and involved in the description of the world. And again, you're going to hear this from me a total of three times. What surprises us interests us. The plot, as it unfolds, has to surprise people. If the plot becomes predictable, you've done something wrong. And it's obvious what's going to happen next, then that can't happen. if what's next is ever obvious, then you need to do something different, and you need to have something unexpected happen. Events, in order for the plot to be interesting, involving, and exciting, it always has to surprise us in some way. And the third thing I would say about plot is that the solution to the plot, in other words, there's some big problem, the plot is going to work out to some big struggle, some big quest for a goal. The solution to that struggle, or the solution to that puzzle, or the achievement of the goal, has got to be intimately tied to the unique aspect of your world. In other words, if you've got a world full of magic, magic should probably have something to do with solving the problem. If you have a science fiction world, and the really unique aspect of that world is that they know how to negate the effect of gravity, somehow that unique aspect has to be involved in the solution of the puzzle. Otherwise, the plot's not really involving you in the world. And the world becomes kind of irrelevant. It diminishes its importance. The uniqueness of it declines to the extent that it's irrelevant to the solution of the central problem of the plot. So in that sense, setting and plot really, that's another way they have to come together towards the end of the novel. Science fiction stories ought to be solved by science. So that's plot. Character. I think character in science fiction has been slighted for too long, and I think that that's changing. I think character is becoming more important. It's still going to be the third tier of this, but I will give you a notion of how important character is becoming, I believe, in science fiction. This book, my first book from Bain Books, has a very unique viewpoint character, Sasha Narodnyo. He's a criminal and a thug and kind of a borderline sociopath, but a nice guy nevertheless. he's only killed like about a dozen people by the time the story starts. But he has a very unique voice. He has a very powerful voice. When Bain Books, the publisher, Tony Weisskopf at Bain Books, emailed me and said, we want this book. She told me later that the thing that really sold this book was Sasha's voice. Sasha's unique voice. This really strong sense of character in the book. Character is becoming more and more important. Characters that used to be were nothing but puppets in science fiction who moved the plot along. They did what was necessary to move the plot and to solve the stuff and for all this other stuff to reveal itself. It's harder and harder to succeed, in my opinion, with characters that are that shallow. And why is that? Because characters, the protagonist in particular, but the characters in general, provide the emotional payoff for readers of the plot. That's where the emotional connection of the reader comes with this world, for a couple of reasons. First, only personal triumph and personal suffering touches people. Joseph Stalin, that astute observer of human nature, once said, when one person dies, it's a tragedy. When a million people die, it's a statistic. absolutely right, at least from the point of view of writing. You know, if you have, you know, if you talk about your giant armies fighting everything, well, that's nice, but that's like history book stuff. But if you tell us about one guy's wound and what he has to go through over the next 6 months recovering from it, and what it, how it changes his life and what he loses because of it, it has some meaning, okay? Suffering matters in individuals, not in masses of people. The struggle of an individual is much more compelling than the struggle. So you, if you're going to tell the struggle of a lot of people, you have to tell it through one exemplar person, your protagonists or your supporting characters, because that's the emotional payoff of the story. The second thing about character is that the character is the window to meaning in the story. I believe that all good fiction, all fiction that lasts, all fiction that touches people, has meaning. That you know, we tell these stories that on the surface are about this, but the reason that we keep telling stories is because it means something more to us. You know, when H.G. Wells told the story of War of the Worlds, it was not just about a science fiction story, was it? Those of you who've read War of the Worlds, most of you probably read War of the Worlds, yeah? It's really about how advanced civilizations treat primitive civilizations. That's really what the meaning of War of the Worlds is. That this advanced Victorian civilization that has treated all these primitive civilizations in Africa and South America and Asia like, you know, subhuman animals, suddenly gets the same treatment from the Martians. And the shoe's on the other foot. And it's how the character kind of is feeling about that as he's experiencing this. And it's the War of the Worlds is about more than just tripods and ray guns. There's something deeper in that, and you see that through the feelings and the thoughts and the experiences of the character. The character in that sense is essential to understanding the character's journey. In my opinion, the character's inner journey, and the character always has an inner journey. The character changes over the course of a novel. That inner journey has to be instrumental in solving the big puzzle. Okay, so the character's got some problem to overcome, some journey to make, and it's by successfully making that inner journey that the character understands how to solve the big plot problem in the story, to the extent that the character solves it. And in H.G. Wells' day, the character didn't have a lot to do with solving stuff. Now, if you're going to get published, you're going to need to have your character actually have some agency and do stuff. But linking that inner journey to the solution of the outer journey is really important. And it also illustrates what I would call and I'm not alone in this, the transactional nature of wisdom. That is to say, what the story, the character's inner story in a nutshell is, what did the character learn and what did it cost him to learn that? Okay, what did he gain and what did he lose? And that's always transactional. If you just learn something and there's no cost, it doesn't mean anything. The cost, in a bizarre way, establishes the value of what you've learned. So, character is important for all of that. And the last thing I would say on character is, who knows what the last thing I'm going to say on character is? What surprises us interests us. Characters have to surprise us. Every person you've ever known in your life who you found interesting interested you because they surprised you. I mean, how many people have you known that said, you know, that guy's fascinating because I know everything he's going to do before he even does it. You know? It's not interesting. It's the people that surprise you that interest you. That are always showing a depth of character you hadn't imagined before. So, your characters, and this isn't just your main character. This is what, for those of you who are really interested in writing, this is what keeps your supporting characters from not being just brainless spear carriers. Those supporting characters really have to keep surprising the reader because that makes them so much deeper in appearance. If you've got the guy who, you know, if you've got the regimental sergeant major in a British unit, you know, who's the classic soldier, the ramrod, straight disciplinary with the barking voice and everything, then you find out that he collects butterflies. you know? and he'll sometimes take off duty and go, there's a real butterfly. Wait, man, if you can have things like that 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 surprise you with an additional element of the personality, the character, it's really the, to my mind, the essence of interesting characters, is characters that keep surprising you. So, that's my main remarks. That's my outline of remarks. Should we do some questions and answers?
If I write my next 16 novels right away, can you read them for me?
Eventually. Now, whether I will is a different question.
I got a fairly simple question.
Yes.
Where you were talking about tying the character together to the final conclusion of the plot of the mm-hmm. novel. Do you ever backtrack from there where you start with the conclusion and say, okay, what does the character need in a modification to...
Oh, you mean in terms of the structure, how you go about writing it? Absolutely. I mean, there's a... And whatever works, you know, there's a lot of different ways of skinning the cat, whatever works. And I think it's really important at the beginning of a story to know where it's going to go. Not everybody agrees. I mean, Stephen King will deny this vociferously. Stephen King says all you have is some characters in a situation, and then they write the rest of it. Well, maybe his do. Mine aren't nearly as talented as his. They need help from me. So when I'm sitting down with a story, I know where it's going to end. And I think it's also really important to know the midpoint of the story. Interestingly enough, that I think that a lot of people don't, there's a real important point in the middle of a story where the protagonist tends to finally kind of look at themselves in a mirror and say, "Huh." There's a guy who does a lot of books on writing called James Scott Bell, and he's written a book called Writing from the Middle, and he's the guy that came up with this, and it's really interesting. He just went through, and he's really big on screenplays, but he went through a whole bunch of films and just found the midpoint of the film. What's going on in the midpoint of the film? And the midpoint of the film is the character kind of going, you're seeing themselves not necessarily in a physical mirror, but, you know, metaphorically, finally seeing themselves and usually not liking what they see. The center point of the film Casablanca is when Ilsa has come to the bar and Rick is there, and Rick basically, here's the woman he loves, the only woman he's ever loved really, and the woman he still loves, and he basically chases her out and calls her a whore. And at the end of the scene, he's sitting at the bar having driven her out, you know, half drunk, looking at a drink, and he just ends up putting his head down in the bar and kind of realizing how low he's fallen, how, you know, what a miserable guy he's become. And from then on, Rick's arc is up for the rest of the film. He's coming back into himself. He's becoming more in control. He's working out what he's going to do instead of just being this kind of guy turning into an alcoholic and depressed and, you know, and just coasting along. I mean, it's kind of an interesting point. There's this clear midpoint where Rick's arc changes because of kind of what he sees in himself. So, yeah, I think it's important also to know that kind of midpoint in the novel. How it's going to end, you've got to get that kind of dark moment of the soul that your character is going to face sometime in the middle. Not exactly the middle, but sometime in the middle, and you know your inciting incident. You've got some posts, some signposts that kind of help you find your way through that story and not go astray. So I think it's important for me as a writer to know that stuff, to have that stuff clearly understood right up front. Yeah.
So when you build your world, first of all, how do you conduct the research, and how much research do you do?
Good questions. I read a lot of popular science, books on popular science. I'm not a trained physicist, but I can fake it, you know. And you kind of have to be able for the hard science stuff. You kind of have to be able to. You have to have an understanding of that. But if you read a lot of speculative science, like Michio Michio Kaku, is that his name? I think so. He's written a number of books about the physics of tomorrow, the physics of science fiction. He's a top-flight physicist. He's done some stuff on NOVA, I think. Mm-hmm. And he's got a great book called The Physics of Tomorrow. I highly recommend it. And in that one, in that book, it should be called The Engineering of Tomorrow, because what he does is he takes the next 100 years and says, what if we don't discover anything new about physics, but just what we know today? What are the engineering and economic implications of it over the course of the next 100 years? Where will we be in 10 years? Where will we be in 50 years? Where will we be in 100 years? And it's just a remarkable exercise in projection. I try to read a lot of books like that.
So it strikes me that being a scientist might be a liability. In other words, I think it's important that you love science, but if you know too much, that might get in the way of your creativity, because you might know that's not right. Mm-hmm. It can get in the way of your creativity.
It might very well. Although there have been a fair number of people who are physicists who've written science fiction, you know. So I think it may depend more on your personality than your vocation. You know, how does your mind bend more towards speculation, or is it more bound into what you know as opposed to what you can imagine? I don't know, but I try to do a lot of research that way, it doesn't have to be really in-depth research. In the new novel, the sequel to How Dark the World Becomes, it's set on the Verroki homeworld. The Verroki are the dominant alien race in this galactic federation, this commonwealth that the humans are part of, and it's set on their home world. And the cities consist mostly of these large arcologies, which are 500,000 to 1.5 million people in a building. I mean, just a big, massive building. And so a city will be a group of 5 or 6 or 7 of those, and some other structures in between. So I did a minimalist amount of mostly looking at pictures of artists' conceptions of what because people are writing about these now in terms of there's some architectural studies of these kind of mega structures as a way of a completely self-contained ecosystem within a building. And they're fascinating things to look at, but I mean, that's pretty much the extent of my research on arcologies. I looked at some pictures, I read some summaries of what architects think arcologies are going to be like. You don't need to know too much about this. You just need to know it to understand this is a plausible concept, and kind of some things about how it would work. So that when you're describing how it works, if that's necessary to the story, you can do it. There is a danger. I mean, one of the things I meant to say and did not is on the subject of setting and world building. I won't say that you can research too much. That's not true. But sometimes it will, when you get all this stuff and you do all this great world building, you feel compelled to tell people about it. You know all this neat stuff, and so you got to like let everybody in on it. No, you don't. You need to tell them what they need for the story. And there is some danger with research of wanting to put it all in. That's why you do rewrites. You know, when you do rewrites, you find all that stuff that's not necessary for the story, and you cut it out. And sometimes it really hurts, you know. But you got to do it. I mean, because it's just not interesting for people to sit and read physics, you know, lessons, or if it's not absolutely essential to the story. And so you just kind of got to jettison. And if you absolutely think you need to have it in there for your world, then you got to figure out a way for it to be important to the story. The story's got to drag it out of you instead of you forcing it into the story.
After they accepted that book, how much time did you have to spend real on rewrite?
The first book, actually, they had very little that they wanted rewritten. The second book, I think I had like 3 or 4, I forget how long I had for rewrites. Probably, I think I had a few months. I mean, no, it wasn't a super tight deadline. The sooner you get it in, the sooner it gets out. But there were more rewrites that we did in the second book than the first book. And we'll see about this third book.
You usually just accept what they suggest as the rewrites?
Well, and the relationship there is interesting because somebody said, who's got the upper hand? Well, nobody. You've both got an absolute veto. I have an absolute veto on what we change in the manuscript, and they have an absolute veto on whether or not they print it, you know. So it's easy. So nobody in that sense has the upper hand, as long as you're willing to say, no, I don't want you to print it with those changes, then they're not going to print it, no problem. But it's not going to get in print then. But I've had pretty good luck with editors. You know, I mean, they'll have a bunch of stuff that they'll think needs changing, and I'll change some of it, and the other stuff will say, this is why I want to keep this the way it is. I mean, I did this for a reason, and I think it's a good reason, and I don't want to change that. And they'll say, well, what, you know, maybe people don't understand that. Maybe need to say something to explain that. And so I'll put in something to explain that. And so, but usually, I've had good experiences with the editors at Bain in terms of being able to work with them, and their suggestions have almost, I've almost always found them helpful. And usually, any criticism you get, usually it's helpful. I mean, you can't lose your own unique view of the world. You can't let that get subordinated to somebody who's got a different view of how it ought to be. But a good editor won't do that. You know, a good editor will help you try to find your message and express it better, and just kind of see from their experience where readers will stumble in your reading, and you know where readers won't quite get what you're doing, and that's it. And you know, so I don't have any experience of bad editors in that respect. Did that answer that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And thanks.
Another.
Yeah.
So, how do you come up with names for objects and things and people that are unique to your world? You know, how many Quatlus or what?
Yeah.
And this is a two-part question. Yeah. When do you decide that it takes away from the story? For example, you know, meters, kilograms, seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, units of time, distance, and you know, at what point? Well, I'm just going to use seconds. I don't want to come up with it because it's going to detract from the story. So how do you balance?
Well, what I do, that's a real concern, because you want the world to be alien sounding, but you don't want it to be difficult for people to remember. And if everybody's name is, you know, 20 syllables long and it's unpronounceable, your readers, the readers can't even keep the character straight at that point. So what I do first in the issue of measure of units of time, I use minutes, seconds, hours. I'll do have a couple comments on the fact that the days on this world are longer or shorter than an Earth day. That people will notice that the Verrocki have a different sort of calendar than we do, and I talk about that. Although it's not a real complicated one, it's just kind of different. And it kind of sounds neat when you hear it. And that's actually the third in the book, in the upcoming book. But it's not. But the Verrocki are a less imaginative race than humans. So a date would be like day 7, 8 month waning, which is the second half of the 8th month of the year, and it's this 8th. And the character comments. These guys are not very creative in their naming conventions, you know, which is why in this world humans are getting really good as a lot of gigs as artists and designers and stuff, because the Verrocki are not very creative. But you know, that's a way of having a different sort of date convention, but it's not one that's really confusing. I mean, once people understand that, they're going to understand that when you say day 3, 7th month waxing, you kind of know right away where you are in the year, but it's not, but it's different, but not real confusing. The names, the Verrocki names, and the Verrocki are real important in this series of books. The Verrocki names, I use as an inspiration Finnish. If you've ever read Finnish, it's really bizarre. So I basically kind of, in terms of the incidence of consonants and vowels, Verrocki sounds a lot like Finnish. Most people in the people that I know have not read much Finnish, so they're not going to pick up on that. And if they do, more power to them. And these aren't real, for the most part, real Finnish names, but they kind of have that pattern. But Finnish names are pretty complicated. So if someone's a recurring important character, they tend to have a very short name, like Boro. One of the characters that recurs is Boro. And so you always know Boro. And then the other thing is that there's another important recurring character who is he's first introduced as the Honorable Arigapai Ilotona. And our hero, who doesn't, who is not a very, let's say, he's not impressed much with titles, immediately dubs him Theon. You know, the Honorable Arigapai Ilotona. Okay, Theon. And Theon is his name for the rest of the book from then on. And the follow-on book. I mean, that just becomes his nickname. So when you've got important characters going to be recurring, you've got to give them something short and punchy that people can remember them by so that it's not they're not stumbling over this complicated name over and over. But that character does have a big alien complicated name, right? So you can establish his alienness and then kind of take it back. You have your characters kind of take it back in a way that makes it easier for them to and your readers to remember. So those are the two things I try to do, is you establish the alienness, but then kind of walk it back a little bit so people can keep remembering. Because, boy, I tell you, if you give them a bunch of characters over and over and over again with just these complicated names, they're just going to, their eyes are going to glaze over.
War and Peace.
Well, yes, it wasn't complicated for Russians, but for some of us, you know, once you get the, and of course, in this book, there's a lot of, there are a lot of Slavic people, and so you have some of the Slavic nicknames show up in these books as well. Sasha is actually Alexander Sergeyevich Narodnyo, but Sasha is the Russian nickname for Alexander. So you get a bit of that in this, because one of the unique aspects in this world, from my point of view, is that so much science fiction world building assumes that in the future, somehow all these enormous cultural differences between all the different nationalities and races of humans are going to be scrubbed away. We're all going to be alike. But we've never managed that before in thousands of years. But in another couple hundred years, well, that's not everybody's going to be alike. And not only that, but all the aliens we meet are all going to be alike. Like they all came from the same island in the Pacific. I don't think that's plausible. I don't think that makes any sense. So one of the aspects of this world is enormous cultural diversity among humans and enormous cultural diversity among these different alien races as well. The Varroki are not all alike at all. They're different nationalities. They got different languages. They got different cultures, and that complicates things. It makes it a very complicated world. So. That's a little far afield, yeah.
How do you tap into the story? Do you set aside time to write, or when something grabs you, you just write on a napkin then go back later and flesh it out, or does something grab you and you?
I try to, if I get an idea, I'll write it down, but I try to be as disciplined as I can be. I'm not a very disciplined person, a lot of those, but I try to be disciplined about writing. And that means I try to write, when I'm actually writing, which is most of the time, I try to write 1,500 words a day in the morning. And if I go more than that, that's good. When I have ideas, at the beginning of a novel, I try to, I take about a month to do as detailed an outline as I can. I know it's going to change, but it gives me a roadmap to begin with. And then it's when I wander off the map, when I rewrite it, I'm okay about reworking the outline as I go. But I like to kind of have an idea of what I'm going to write before I start writing it. It's easier to write if you kind of know sitting down what it is you want to write for that day. And sometimes that can lead you other places, and that's fine. But I like to know as much as I can what I'm doing before I start. And then I like to write every day and hit a pretty good word count every day. And if later I end up throwing out, and then the current novel, there was times when I took about 5,000 words and threw them out. And then later, I threw another 5,000 words and threw them out. Well, that's the way it goes. You got to write good. You got to write bad, you know. And then throw some of that stuff out. But I like to just keep writing and keep writing and keep writing and just keep at it and just keep punching at it every day until you get it done. And then you go back and you fix it.
And plot, character, and setting are your compass, I guess.
Yeah, primarily character. I list character last because I think in science fiction it is last, but personally, with me, the stories always start with character. That's kind of where I start, is with the character and the character's voice. And I think that is important. And I emphasize unique, unique, unique all the time because, I mean, if you've got, I don't know how many times that, you know, people say, well, I read this book, I could write that good. Well, too bad, you know, because a book that good has already been published and that niche has been taken and we don't need that one now, you know? You know, I could write that book. Yeah, but somebody else already did. You know, you've got to write something different because people have already read that. And so you've always got to be thinking about, you know, what's special about what you're writing, you know? And if you can't think of anything special about what you're writing, nobody else is going to. You know, you've got to really think. I think you've got to believe that what you're writing is worthwhile and is special and says something about your characters and maybe says something about the world. Doesn't have to say anything big, but it's got to say something.
What's been your feedback in terms of critical reviews and people in the science fiction community to your books?
I think that, you know, they've been well received. You know, to the extent you can tell from Amazon reviews, you know, they're pretty good. I will say, you know, every once in a while you get a bad review. What I do when I get a bad review is, I really like James Lee Burke. I don't know how many of you read any James Lee Burke. He's a crime mystery novelist. Great writer. He's just really good. And every time I get a kind of bad review, I'll go on Amazon and I'll go to one of my favorite James Lee Burke books and I'll read a 2-star or 1-star review of it. I'll say, all right, you know, everybody gets rotten reviews once in a while. You can't please everybody. And I think it's a mistake. I really believe it's a mistake to try to please everybody. I mean, I read reviews and I take what they say. I process what they say. I don't just say, oh, you're stupid. But I also understand that if you try to write to everybody, you homogenize what you're writing. You've got to accept the fact that no matter how good or you are, somebody's not going to like it. There's a lot of people who really have great reasons for not liking James Lee Burke. He's a great writer, you know? If he tried to satisfy those people, he would water down what he's doing. And you can't, so you can't let, you got to accept that some people who are intelligent and have good taste and have excellent reasons just aren't going to like your stuff. Let them go.
Yeah, I'd be happy to sell to only 10% of the U.S.
Well, actually, I was reading something that said that really a musician, an author, if you're a reasonably prolific working author or musician, 2,000 fans, and you're made. That's about what you need. If you've got 2,000, between 1 and 2,000 really dedicated fans who buy everything you do and talk about it to their friends and get some of them to buy some of them, you're okay. You're going to be you've got a base to be commercially successful. So trying to write a book that will appeal to everyone in the world is, I think, a fool's errand. You got to think about who you want to write to. And to a certain extent, you're always writing to yourself, right? You're writing the book that you'd like to read. And yet, so your audience is yourself and people like you, and you know, people who think like you and have similar tastes. And I think you have to write to that. I mean, one of the things I would say in terms of this notion of your market and what you're going after, and finding books that you like, I would not encourage you to try to write books in areas where you have authors you think are doing a wonderful job. Okay? Because if your itch is getting scratched already, what are you going to write? You know, if there's somebody who's doing a spectacular job of answering what you want, then what is it that's compelling you to write that? You need to find an area where you'd like to read something, but you can't find anybody that satisfies you. That's where you need to go. I really want a book like this, and nobody's really writing it. Well, then write it. You know, that's your opening, right? Write the book you'd like to read that no one's giving you, that no one's given you yet. I think that, you know, that's certainly what, you know, that's certainly been my approach. I mean, I'm writing a steampunk book, but it's not like any steampunk book I've ever read. And How Dark the World Becomes is hard science fiction noir, You know, it's really also kind of 1930s noir with a science fiction background. I mean, it's a different sort of book than any I've read. It's got a different sort of attitude. So I think to the extent either of these books are successful, they are successful because they're not exactly like anything else out there. And I think that's always going to be where a writer finds their success, is in doing something that just nobody else has quite done.
Frank, you mentioned that you've got two different series there,
yeah.
Two different universes, mm-hmm. Two different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Does it help you to jump back and forth creatively about writing rather than stay with the one genre forever? Does it help you to do? Is it make it better to do writing on one and then the other?
I think for me, it helps to be able to write what I feel like writing, and not feel like I'm trapped into writing something. You know, I mean, it really helped to not do the sequel to How Dark the World Becomes right away. You know, I needed to do something else for a while because I was done writing that. I mean, when I was done with this book, I was sorry to be finish it because I got used to hanging around with Sasha every day, and I really like Sasha. You know, and then, ah, geez, it's over. You know, now what do I do? But I still wasn't ready. But his journey was so old. You know, he had finished this journey. I wasn't ready to throw him back in the cannibal pot again. You know, he needed some time to kind of enjoy his success too. And that sounds strange, but that's kind of where your head is with your character. So I needed to get away from him and write something else for a while, and then come back and tell Sasha's next story. So I think it helps to be able to kind of move around a little bit, but I don't know that will always be the case. And I think there's a considerable market pressure right now. Self-publishing and e-publishing is really changing the face of publishing in ways that nobody knows. Lots of people have theories. And in 5 years, we'll know which ones were right and which ones were wrong. But I mean, right now, anybody who says they know what's coming up, I think, is kidding themselves. But one of the things that I've seen is a much, much stronger pressure to complete series quickly. To start a series and a series of three or four or five books and bang, 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 come out with them fairly quickly. And I think that pressure is going to increase. And a lot of it's because there is less lag time for self-publication authors than there is for traditional publication authors. I finish a book for Bain, and it's about 9 to 12 months before it's going to hit the shelves. And it's not because it takes them that long to laboriously typeset. It's because in order to make a physical book economically viable, it has to have a certain number of sales into bookstores right up front when it's actually printed. And that requires a lot of ground level sales work to those stores and preparing and getting orders and making sure everybody's on board and understands how to sell the book and setting up things so the book will sell, so that when the book's finally printed, bang, it goes right out there into the stores and a bunch sell through right away. Otherwise, it's not viable to print stacks and stacks of these physical things. When you're doing nothing but an ebook and you're doing it yourself, you finish it and you format it and it's live on Amazon the next day, and there is none of that lead time. Now, a lot of them don't sell anything, but once an author starts building up a following and he has those 1,000 fans, right, those 1,000 dedicated fans, he comes out with those books, and as fast as he can come out with them, they sell. And if he can finish a series in a year instead of 5 years, his fans are happy. Because let's face it, people read faster than writers write. You know, so if you like a series, you read the book, it takes you like a day or two of solid reading to read a book. Now you spread that out over a week or two, right? Or maybe longer. But in terms of if you got a weekend, you sit down with a book, you're gonna finish it in a day or two. And then when you get done, you say, wow, this is really cool. When's the next one coming? 18 months. Oh, geez. But if it's coming in 2 months or 1 month, are you ready to buy another one? And yeah, of course you are. Of course you are. So that's changing publishing in some interesting ways, and it's causing much more pressure to come to follow up series much more quickly in order to maintain reader loyalty. Because I think if the traditional publishers don't do it, the independent e-writers who've actually developing a following are going to take some readers away from traditional publishers. So we'll see what happens with that. But I mean, I think that's something that's coming. So there's going to be more of a premium right now and in the foreseeable future in sitting down and not writing a novel, but sitting down and mapping out a series and writing it almost all at the same time and getting it released as fast as possible. Yes.
When you're writing a book, do you mm-hmm. keep a sort of a style sheet of all the characters and the rules of physics in that world so that you don't, you know?
The rules of physics I don't have a problem with so much, but I do develop as I'm going along a character list, a planetary gazetteer, a kind of running list of how the politics work and the political organizations and things like that. That I do.
So you don't just keep it all in your head and just write?
Well, the first one I did, but when you come around, you know, a year or so later, you come around to the second book and you say, well, you know, I better go back and start compiling all that stuff so they can keep it straight with the first book. The first book, with one book, is pretty easy, in my opinion, in my experience, to keep all that straight. I think I probably wrote down the names of the odd alien names of plants so I get the spellings always right. But it wasn't that hard for me to keep the stuff straight in one book. But across multiple books, it starts getting difficult. And yeah, you have to... So I've developed kind of a Bible on Sasha's work. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Easier to put together a book or a board game?
Depends on the book and depends on the board game. I know that's kind of a weaselly answer, but it's when a board game goes together right, it's a thing of beauty. You know, and everything goes click, 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 and you send it off, and it's done. And I've done some board games that went together very easily, and I've done some board games that were enormously difficult. But I have to say that it probably takes longer to write a novel than it does to do a board game, even including most of the research. There's a lot more involved in a novel than there is in a board game, even a big board game. So I guess upon consideration, it's harder. There's more work involved in putting together a novel, a book, than there is a board game.
Frank, you've also written nonfiction.
Yes.
Okay. I'm interested in nonfiction, but mm-hmm. I don't know if the other people would appreciate this, but I'm kind of curious the difference that you've encountered because you've written both ways. Mm-hmm. You're making up a story in a world that does not exist. Mm-hmm. But there seems to me to be not exactly discipline, but certain aspects of writing that are similar between nonfiction and fiction. Have you found that to be true?
Similar. There are some similar aspects, and there are some very dissimilar aspects. And it's a good question. The act of cranking out words is just sitting down and writing words, sentences, paragraphs, and understanding how those work together. Is invaluable practice, and however you do it, it helps you in all the other aspects of it. Just in terms of easily sitting down and being comfortable making sentences and paragraphs and pages, filling them up with words, you know. I mean, that's just useful. So that certainly helps. The nonfiction work and the research on board games and stuff like that is really helpful in world building. And building a believable understand. If you don't understand how things work, it's very hard to explain how they work to people in a way that will find compelling and convincing. You know, if you don't have any understanding of how you grow food, it's hard to explain an agrarian economy to people. So knowing stuff, just knowing stuff, is a real help in world building and and explaining that, that sort of stuff to people. The downside, and this is true, this is particularly true of the question about board games and about writing rules in general, is that in writing rules, the hardest thing you have to learn, and you have to do it for years before you start getting good at it and before it becomes second nature, is that you cannot leave anything to the gamer's imagination. You can't have any ambiguity in the rule at all, because if you do, they will just come up with extraordinarily weird answers to things, you know, and ask you questions about, does it mean this? Does it mean that? You can't have any ambiguity. You have to explain everything in excruciating detail and very clearly. And that is really death in fiction. Because in fiction, you've got to leave a lot of room in the writing for the reader to be part of the process. You've got to leave holes for the reader to wonder about and for the reader to fill stuff in. I mean, if you describe in excruciating detail everything about a physical person's a physical appearance, the reader doesn't have anything to do. But if you just give a couple details and then the reader fills in the rest, the reader's kind of invested in that character now. So there's the hardest thing to unlearn in writing fiction is this necessity from gaming and some nonfiction writing to write without ambiguity and explaining absolutely everything. You just can't do that. And a little bit of ambiguity is good in fiction. You want people wondering because, I mean, is there anything in the world we experience that's absolutely unambiguous? You know, I don't know that there is. You know, every person we meet, there's always some ambiguity involved in, you know, we don't really know what anybody is thinking. You know, we think we can, we know what they do, we know what they look like, we know what the expression they appear to have, and from that we assume what they're thinking. But we don't really know, because unless you can read minds. I mean, I can't read minds, right? So, yeah, I mean, that's the big difference in my mind, is that need to back off of, you know, excruciating detail, yeah, of explaining everything. Anything else?
What was your biggest disappointment after doing this? Did you have a disappointment? I mean, this is a lot of work. You told me your first novel, the hard fiction, mm-hmm. hard science fiction. You wrote for a long time before that got published.
Oh, yeah. In terms of my biggest disappointments in writing, I started writing about 15 years ago, I started writing historical fiction. And I've written, I don't know, 4 or 5 novels that finish it, throw it away. because I discovered, as much as I loved historical fiction, I discovered in writing historical fiction, the characters were, I was too interested in the history. And so the characters didn't have a lot of agency. The characters the characters were kind of just spectators to a certain extent of what was going on around them. They weren't able to influence it. And that was killing the story. I mean, those weren't good stories, because stories are about what characters do, not what gets done to them, you know? So that's why I switched to science fiction. I said, well, I'm not going to have that problem in science fiction, because they can make the history. You know, the history is what I say it is. So that's why I switched to science fiction. But I'm about to go back to historical fiction. I think the teaser in this thing said I might be able to persuade her to talk about a secret project or two. I've been working on, and I started this is one of the historical novels I started and discarded a number of years ago. But I'm going to do a series of novels on the Achaemenid Persian Empire, culminating in the last novel, which may be the first novel that's released, is Alexander's conquest of the empire, the end of that empire. And the difference is that the story is told from the point of view of the Persians, and they're the good guys. Unequivocally the good guys in the story. So that's kind of the unique. What's unique about the world is that this view of a completely different view of the Persians than you will get from, say, 300 you know, where they're into piercings and weird stuff like that. So that's kind of my big secret project.
You gave a great talk on that, by the way. Alexander and his gangsters are the bad guys.
His thugs. Yeah. His vandals.
Yes. I always enjoyed that talk. It was just great. It wasn't so much true counterfactual, but it was, you know.
It was counterintuitive.
Counterintuitive.
Yes. Right. It's not counterfactual at all.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely different from what people were expecting, because they're expecting to have the Victorian British presentation of the great, wonderful Alexander, earning his title great by beating up on the backward, you know, decadent, corrupt Persians.
Mean Persians.
Mean old Persians, right? And your presentation of, no, let's take a look at this, you know, because they lost. The winner wrote the history, and the British really put the worst spin on it you could possibly get. So just being able to look at it differently, think differently about it, I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one project. What's the other thing you're talking about?
Well, the other thing I'm talking about is a series of... more military. I mean, there's military science fiction in both of these. I mean, and I like to write military science fiction. They're not primarily military science fiction books, but they have some strong military science fiction aspects to them. And I'm looking at a series of books set in Sasha's universe, but Sasha's not the main character. And they would be more space navy science fiction. And this first series of books. I've really, really become intrigued with the 1942 naval actions off Guadalcanal, which I'm doing a talk on tomorrow. Fascinating naval campaign, just fascinating. And the elements of that campaign, the logistical constraints, the effects of leadership, the way that people just... It takes a while when a war starts for people to realize they're really in a war. You know, this is like real stuff. That you see that in the, you know, those are the kind of the things I want to address. Because most military science fiction I read assumes everybody comes to the show ready to go. That like they've spent their whole life, you know, getting ready for this one thing, and that's all they are. And that's not what people are. People aren't like that. They're people first. And then they're, you know, then they're guys doing a job in uniform second, right? So that's my other project is a military space navy series, but it's at least the early part of it is very closely based on all the stuff that happens in the Guadalcanal campaign, and all the just bizarre stuff, but also some really interesting insights I think into what naval warfare was. Like other than just the machines.
So it's a parallel universe.
It's Sasha's universe.
Parallel story in the same universe.
Yeah, and it's and the cause of the war is stuff that's happened in the first book. The first book really sets up that there's some trouble coming, and so that was that would start addressing that. So that's my other project that I'm working on.
Are these books for sale?
Yeah. If anybody actually wants to read this stuff, you know. Yes, I have a couple copies of each available, and I'll even sign them for you. No extra charge. Any other questions? Well, thanks for coming.